I'm Emma Greed, host of Aspire with Emma Greed, a podcast where I sit down with people who don't just dream big, they build big. From culture-shaping voices like Mel Robbins to leaders redefining success like Tracy Ellis Ross to game-changing entrepreneurs like Mark Cuban, Aspire is about mindset, ambition, and doing the work that actually moves the needle. If you're ready to raise your standards and take charge about the life and career you're building, Aspire is where you start. Follow and listen to Aspire with me, Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast available wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, you show me a picture of a cute kid that was killed in a school shooting and it's somebody else's kid. But if you show me pictures of the bedrooms and what they left behind, it all of a sudden becomes your room. It's your child's room.
This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We bring you the latest true crime news reported out of Odyssey stations across the country. You just heard the voice of CBS News correspondent Steve Hartman. Last weekend, the film All the Empty Rooms won an Oscar for Best Documentary Short. Hartman and a photographer worked on the film together to provide a fresh perspective on the aftermath of mass shootings and what they do to the loved ones that victims leave behind. Later in this episode, we'll hear Hartman's interview about the project with Odyssey station KCBS in the Bay Area. We'll also hear about the latest development in the 2x4 killer case out of Kansas. 25 years after she was convicted of brutally killing her husband, Tyler Ann Block, formerly known as Tyler Block Patton, is now up for parole. Dana Wright of the Dana and Parks Show out of Odyssey station KMBZ in Kansas City once interviewed the convicted killer. She shared her memories of the case this week and weighed in on new updates. Before we get to those stories, we have a quick roundup of new crime reports from Odyssey stations this week. Out of WWJ News Radio in Detroit, we have coverage of a man accused of killing his partner.
WWJ's Charlie Langton joining us live with the details. And Charlie, is this another question of more questions than answers right now?
At this point in time, it is. It does appear, though, that a woman is dead and her husband is the murderer. At least that's what police are saying or kind of hinting at this point in time. This happened yesterday around 5:30 or so in Centerline. Police arrived at the couple's home on Sterling Street. There they found a 38-year-old woman shot with a single gunshot wound. She died at the scene. But police then were able to figure out that it was likely her 39-year-old husband who killed her. A short time later, that husband was arrested near 10 Mile and Van Dyke, not far from the home. But again, no details given as to the reason for the shooting. This does remain an active and continuing investigation.
CBS News later identified the victim as 38-year-old Erica Marie Sanders, and the alleged killer is 39-year-old Zachary Fuqua. It's said that three of Sanders' children, all under 17 years old, were home at the time of the shooting. In Philadelphia, Odyssey station KYW News Radio provided updates this week on funeral services for State Police Corporal Timothy O'Connor, who was shot dead earlier this month during a traffic stop.
Hundreds of mourners came to Downingtown to honor a Pennsylvania state trooper who was killed in the line of duty last week. KYW's Vic Ragapathy was there.
Hundreds of people filed into St. Joseph's Church in Downingtown over the course of Tuesday evening. Out in the parking lot, two cherry pickers held up a massive American flag as the public gathered to view the late 40-year-old Pennsylvania State Police Corporal Timothy O'Connor Jr. Philadelphia Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel showed up with his officers out of solidarity.
It's important that I bring my entire team down here to show that honor and their reverence and to his family, that his work matters, that he mattered, and so it's just an honor to be here.
O'Connor was conducting a traffic stop in West Cowan Township, Chester County, shortly before 8:30 on Sunday, March 8th. Officials say during that traffic stop, Jesse Nathan Elks of Honeybrook shot O'Connor, then turned the gun on himself. In a statement, the president of the Pennsylvania State Troopers Association called O'Connor's death, quote, a deep and profound loss, end quote, and a reminder of the danger of the job. O'Connor was a 15-year veteran of the force. A private funeral will be held Wednesday morning here at St. Joseph's. O'Connor is survived by his wife, Casey, and their 6-year-old daughter.
Funeral today in Downingtown for Pennsylvania State Police Corporal Timothy O'Connor. KYW's Connor Barkon joined us live this morning from St. Joseph's Church.
He is being remembered today by family, friends, and colleagues. The police brotherhood, again, it's just on full display out here. There was such a large procession of attendees to this funeral that traffic needed to be stopped so they could arrive here and safely get to the church where this service is being held. The funeral, it's private today, as is the burial that will follow. The public paid respects last night when a viewing was held for the 15-year veteran of the force. Philadelphia Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel brought his team so that they could pay their respects.
It is a brotherhood and a sisterhood. You know, these men and women get up every day and give their lives for this job. When I walk through those church doors, I'm reminded of all the men and women we lost in Philadelphia Police Department.
KYW also reported on a new arrest related to a years-old crime.
A Camden County man faces life in prison after being convicted of kidnapping and trying to murder his girlfriend in a shooting almost 2 years ago. Here's KYW South Jersey reporter Mike Doherty.
Jurors found 33-year-old Akeem Morton guilty on all charges, including first-degree kidnapping, attempted murder, and aggravated assault, following a two-week trial. The Camden County Prosecutor's Office says back in December of 2024, he and his girlfriend were arguing inside of his car at the intersection of Clementon Road and Haddon Avenue in Gibbsboro. At one point, Morton drove away without letting her out. Officials say she eventually jumped out of the moving car. That's when they say Morton shot her several times, put her back in the car, and drove her to nearby Jefferson Stratford Hospital. Morton was arrested at the hospital. Sentencing is set for May 8th, and he faces a mandatory life sentence.
Odyssey station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities reported on a murder investigation underway in a small Minnesota community.
Authorities say the killings of a woman and young boy in a home in Lexington overnight were not random, and a suspect is in custody. Few other details have been made public, but Anoka County Sheriff's Department spokeswoman Tierney Peters tells WCCO-TV the small community northwest of Minneapolis is reeling.
Their loss is going to be felt, not only by their loved ones and their friends, but people who may not have personally known them but are in that community. These crimes are heartbreaking.
The search for the suspect involved 7 law enforcement agencies, drones, and a canine.
What's up, little psychos? I'm Investigator Slater, host of the Psychopedia podcast. Psychopedia is a true crime podcast delivering raw, real, and absolutely gripping episodes every single week. I dig deep to uncover fascinating details of heinous true crime cases while exploring criminology and psychology theories. I take you into the absolute darkest corners of the human psyche, my favorite territory, and present cases like you've never heard them before. Follow and listen to Psychopedia everywhere you get your podcasts.
That concludes our recent crime news roundups for this week. Now we'll hear from the Dana and Parks Show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City about the 2x4 murder.
A woman convicted of killing her husband in a brutal homicide, so brutal that there were detectives at that scene that say they will never forget it as long as they live. Is now up for parole after 25 years. Her name was Tyler Block Patton. You remember that name, Scott? Blonde.
Mm-hmm.
Convicted of beating her husband to death with a 2x4 while he slept, is up for parole for the first time. And the people who loved him are asking the public to help keep her behind bars. Block Patton, who now goes by Tyler Ann Block, was convicted of first-degree premeditated murder in the death of her husband, Ed Patton Jr., a well-known Overland Park real estate broker. The murder was in their home, Scott. I interviewed this woman in her mother-in-law's house. She had already killed him. Everyone kind of knew it was probably her. She was dumb enough to agree to an interview.
Why?
There wasn't a lot going on upstairs, okay? She didn't call authorities till 2 days after he was bludgeoned to death 7, 8, 9 times with a 2x4 in bed while he slept. Her DNA was found on that 2x4 out back, so was his. And to this day, she will not admit that she did it. But she is so guilty, and she is now up for parole. It's been 25 years. She got life, but it's been 25 years.
And?
Does
she get out?
I think all of the detectives who are still around, as well as his family, will come forward. I think his mom's probably long passed. They will come forward and absolutely try to block this. She's now 75. This was a savage.
Was there a motive? Not that one would be
money. She wanted out. There was an argument.
Asked for a divorce.
There was an argument on tape. They'd only been married, I think, a year.
I know the feeling.
And when she called 911 to report something was wrong, he had been dead for 2 days. And I'll never forget it when authorities got to the house. She's the woman that kept saying, they killed him. I knew they killed him. They were going to kill him. They killed him. And I asked her later, what do you mean by that? You said they killed him. And she goes, the cigarettes. I mean, I just knew when they got there that, you know, the cigarettes probably finally got him.
With a 2x4?
She was a bizarre, loony, bizarre human being.
And what are you thinking the entire time you're doing this interview?
That she killed her husband. And
are you thinking, keep talking, or you need to shut up?
Did you kill her? Did you kill him? And she said, no, but she looked down to the left when she said it.
You know what that means.
No, I did not. Of Ed, his friend Paul Swanson, who worked as a real estate agent for him, said he was gentle, he was kind, he was funny. He had a very generous personality. Said he learned of Ed's death when he saw his house on the evening news. I said, oh my God, that's Ed's house. 25 years is not enough because it was so brutal. Normal people do not bash somebody in the head over and over and over again. She should not be on the streets. I would not feel safe with her out. Paul Morrison tried that case and said that letters and testimony from people are helpful when the parole board is looking at stuff.
Dana is referring to former Johnson County, Kansas District Attorney Paul Morrison, who was on the case back in the early 2000s.
He also says he has never seen the board release someone convicted of premeditated first-degree murder at the first eligible hearing. But I always wonder in cases like this when it's a woman. She presents as a 75-year-old woman. Some would call that elderly, Scott. I don't. But
Most people would.
And does she really present a danger to anyone else? If it was a man, I don't even think we'd be talking about it.
No, we wouldn't. If a man had bludgeoned his wife with a 2x4 that severely,
He's a threat to society.
There's no chance that this guy's getting out of prison after 25 years.
Ed Patton had no defensive injuries on his hands or arms, indicating he was sound asleep or otherwise incapacitated when he was killed.
And she did it for the money?
I believe at the time he did have a sizable estate,
Were
Scott.
There any affairs going on that we're aware of?
He had a sizable estate, and I think if memory serves, he had life insurance.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's...
I mean, she's not even a good liar. If your opening line is, I knew they did it, at least come up with something about how he had some bad business deal with somebody.
It was the cigarettes! In fact, you know that show Snapped?
It was that
OP Mafia.
Like,
every once in a while you see this on, like, Identity Discovery. And one day, she just snapped. They did an entire episode on that case.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. For this episode's final true crime dispatch, we're going back to that first quote we heard at the top of the show. Steve Hartman, a CBS reporter who worked on the Academy Award-winning documentary All the Empty Rooms, joined Odyssey station KCBS in the Bay Area this week to discuss the film and our gun violence issues in the U.S.
It has been quite a journey from coming up with this idea to what happened, you know, Sunday at the Oscars?
It has been. I started the project and I did not tell my bosses at CBS News because I kind of do the feel-good stories that come at the end of the evening news, and this was so far off brand. It was one of those things where I felt maybe it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. So I just went at it and brought in a friend of mine, a still photographer named Lou Bope, and we were photographing these rooms for years before I finally even mentioned it to CBS, let alone, you know, tried to make a documentary out of it.
I think for many of us, our first exposure to the project was segments on CBS Sunday Morning, where it was featured.
That's right. The documentary basically follows me on the journey of making that story. That's what the film was kind of about. And it has, it won an Oscar. The filmmaker did an amazing job, and it's much more detailed and much more powerful than I could ever do with a news piece. And I'm really so glad that I got the filmmakers, Josh Seftel, filmmaker out of New York City, and Connell Jones, who's there out of California and just south of you guys a little bit, who did just a wonderful job with the film.
All the Empty Rooms wins the Oscar for Best Documentary Short. We're talking about it today. It's getting a lot of buzz. What is your hope for the film's message?
When I started this, my biggest concern was the country had grown numb to school shootings. I had grown numb. I covered some of these things and I even had forgotten about them, and I'd certainly forgotten about the victims, and it was not sitting well with me. So the goal was to sort of provide a reset, because, you know, the conversation about how to solve this epidemic has been stuck. It's immediately polarized, and I just wanted people to feel again. That was my objective from the beginning. But as we got going, you know, and I started talking to the parents, all they wanted was for people to remember their child who was lost, and for hopefully that death to have some kind of greater purpose. So that became kind of what I wanted most out of this. And that was my greatest joy when they opened that envelope and it said All the Empty Rooms, and all the parents were there with us. All the parents who lost the child in a school shooting, who were featured in the film, were there in the auditorium with us, and their tears of joy was the emotional part, for me, and it had become my purpose.
So you talk about how this issue had been gnawing at you, and you felt like you couldn't do anything. So you decide to do something. How do you reach out to these families? How do you make contact with them? Do you just knock on their door?
No, I wrote letters to pretty much every family that lost a child in the school shooting since Sandy Hook. And I FedExed them the letters, and I explained that I know this is a huge ask, and I was asking to, you know, photograph something that oftentimes close friends and family aren't even allowed to see. The doors are sometimes locked. They remain, as you said, frozen in time, just as they were. So it took a lot of trust building, I guess. I explained what my hope was for this, that someday I dreamed of maybe there being a photo exhibit or a documentary. And in the end, 8 families agreed.
An unmade bed, hair ties on a doorknob, a boy's first razor, pajamas tossed on the floor where they were left that morning. What different reasons did families give for keeping their children's bedrooms untouched?
For families who've gone through this, it almost feels like packing up the room would be almost another stage of grief for them, just another thing they have to go through. And many of them aren't ready to do that just yet. It takes some weeks, some months, some years. And you can just imagine the closure that would have to come with taking their things, what they prized most, these kids, and putting them in a cardboard box or giving them away to Goodwill. It's almost like that last goodbye. So the families that still saved the rooms, I think part of it was just, not wanting to take that step, but also as a way to keep the child alive. They still will go in there, still hold the stuffies. In some cases still smell the dirty laundry and keep that memory alive, because they say that, you know, little by little, you know, you start to forget what the voice sounded like and what the blankie smelled like. And it's just, they do not want to let go.
When you reach out to these families and you explain what you want to do, What kind of responses did you receive?
Well, I'd say most people did not respond. There were those who responded and said, we'd love to be part of this, but, you know, we did pack up the room, or the room has been repurposed. You know, I think there's a hesitancy, you know, anytime a reporter reaches out to these families, because oftentimes immediately after the tragedy, that's when the reporters show up and knock on the door and ask for interviews at a time when they really should just be left alone. So really the only way that this becomes possible is after months and sometimes years, when things have settled and they're ready to share the stories of their children. And the eight families that agreed, I think they were just ready.
Steve, I know you're a dad. Can you talk about the emotional challenges you faced personally over the 7 years it took to complete this film?
Yeah, I mean, you go into these rooms and it is like stepping back in time, and you look around the you look around the room and you see many of the same things that are in your child's room. The same little metal bank that your kid has, and the same shells that they save. So you can't go in these rooms without seeing some of your child. A colleague of mine told me after watching the film, you know, you show me a picture of a cute kid that was killed in a school shooting and it's somebody else's kid. But if you show me pictures of the bedrooms and what they left behind, it all of a sudden becomes your room. It's your child's room. And that was really what we were trying to accomplish. We want America to stand in these rooms. And I think not until we stand in these rooms and feel what I felt when I was there and what the parents feel, can we even begin to try to come up with a solution.
You know, something I didn't catch as I screened the film, I didn't actually notice this until I saw you talking to Chelsea Clinton on her podcast. The word gun isn't really used in this film.
No, and that's by design. Again, if we did a film that was just catered to the right or the left, it would fall on deaf ears. It had to be a film that was not political. I'm certainly not political in any way, and I wasn't about to start now. Partly because it's not my job, I'm a journalist, but partly because I don't really have any strong feelings on this. I don't know necessarily what the solution is, but I know it's going to begin with the two sides coming together and not stay dug in their positions. It might have something to do with guns, the solution, it might not. We would really like to be able to screen this for Congress. But it can't be just one side showing up. There are other documentaries on this issue that have done that. It needs to be both sides coming together, starting with the film, and seeing how the discussion bubbles up from there.
So that was a strategic, intentional, by design decision to not use that three-letter word, gun.
Right, because then immediately you're preaching to half the country. And that's not going to get us anywhere. So it had to start at a place of just empathy. And that's all the film was about, is trying to restore empathy.
You're listening to Ask an Expert on KCBS. I'm Steve Scott. We are talking with CBS News correspondent Steve Hartman about the award, Oscar-winning documentary, All the Empty Rooms. Steve, I know, you know, with all the school shootings, we thought, well, okay, Sandy Hook, this has to move the needle. Parkland, okay, this has to move the needle. Uvalde, this has to move the needle. And yet the needle never seems to move. Do you have any hope that All the Empty Rooms can move the needle?
I have more hope now that it won an Oscar. There's a very bright spotlight shining on this film right now. And when I say more hope, it's still a sliver of hope, because people are really entrenched in their positions on this. But hopefully, you know, hopefully if enough people see it, if the right people see it, certainly if the whole country sees it, then I think there is a chance.
I wonder what surprised you the most about making this film. Anything that took your breath away?
You know, I guess what surprised me most is, because of the nature of the subject, I thought it would just be all tears and really sad. And it is certainly very sad. But when you spend time in the rooms with the parents, you start talking about the things in there and get to know the child, there were a lot of laughs too. You saw the film. You probably saw the bit about the kitty cat hoodie and the little girl who had to have that kitty cat hoodie. And you know, we did a lot of laughing with the parents and a lot of crying, but it's not all doom and gloom. You know, as you explore a life and learn about a life, you're going to do a lot of smiling too. And you're going to learn about that child. And that's the other thing, you know, even if the message doesn't get through, people will get to know these children. And, you know, for me and for the parents, that's accomplishment enough.
Do you think some of the parents found it therapeutic to open these closed doors into these untouched rooms and let you and photographer Lou Bope and then America and the world see these rooms?
I know for at least one family, it was very helpful because they've told me so, and they have since been able to pack up the room. This was the Muhlberger family. They lost their daughter, Gracie, in a Saugus, California shooting. And that room had stayed much as it was. Brian Muhlberger had gotten jobs other places, good jobs that he would have loved to have taken. They would have loved to move, but they just could not surrender that room. But through the process of, you know, being a part of the documentary, and we sent them photo books, you know, of the pictures that we'd taken, and having the photo book and going through the process, they were finally able to pack up the room, sell the house and move. So it was therapeutic for them. And I think, you know, for the others too, although in most of the other rooms, most of the other families, the rooms remain just as they were when I was there.
We're getting some questions in from our KCBS listeners, Steve. Listener Maurice asks, what would be your ideal outcome for this film? What would you like to see as a result?
It's pretty simple, really. I would like to, and I'm just going to talk about sort of a political hope. I'd like to be able to screen it for Congress. We tried this once and virtually nobody showed up. But now we've won an Oscar, we'll maybe try again. I'd like to do a screening for Congress, have it be bipartisan, and when it's over, and I know what it feels like when the film's over, I've been to many screenings, in that moment, I would like somebody to look across the aisle and say, you know, let's have lunch, let's talk about this. Just two people from different sides. That's my hope for a political outcome from this.
When you go to the screenings, and the film comes to an end, the credits roll, is there silence in the room?
Yeah. It's a different film in that way because people don't really clap. They need some time to just sit there. And we knew that would be the case. Some people dread that. We've had people say, I just can't watch it. I can't watch it. It's amazing, you know, the blood and gore and guts that people watch on TV. But when it comes to this subject, And this issue told in such a powerful way, people say, oh, I can't watch it. But I've never met anybody who watched it and says, I regret watching that. There's a bit of hope that comes at the end. And you feel a little bit of that hope at the end, but it is quiet. It is quiet. People do need to soak it in. And it's in that moment that I hope, like I say, that it could be a couple Congress people in that moment will look past their differences, look at each other in the eye and say, okay, let's go back to square one and let's talk about this again.
Steve, in our last couple of minutes together, I want to ask you about three specific people. First, tell us about the Uvalde mom who lost her daughter in the school shooting there in 2022. She was on stage alongside you to accept the Oscar Sunday night.
Yeah, that's Gloria Cazares. And she's done some public speaking. She was obviously thrust into the spotlight, you know, against her will. But she has since become a very powerful speaker who, you know, can speak from the heart. And we knew that we did not want our acceptance speech to be a bunch of thank yous to this person and that, because nobody who took part of this film project did it for any kind of thank you. So we didn't have to do that. And we wanted to hand over the microphone to one of the parents. And, you know, Gloria knew there'd be a billion people watching, but she got up there and she talked about her daughter from the heart. And it's really what I think everybody remembers from the Oscars is her talk.
Warriors coach Steve Kerr, who lost his own father to gun violence, a terrorist assassination, was an executive producer to help get this film seen. How important was that kind of support in getting the story out?
Well, I mean, it's extremely important. You know, you want people to, we needed support in many ways. This was an independent film, and there was, so we needed people to give money. We needed people, we needed big names, you know, famous names to sign up and say, I believe in this. I want to join these people. It took people like Steve Kerr and Adam McKay, you know, pretty popular filmmaker, to step in and say, hey, everybody, let's look at this. Let's try to fund this. Let's make this come to life. And Steve was very gracious. He attended multiple screenings. He wrote an op-ed for the LA Times. He's done interviews since. So we're very grateful for everything that he's contributed.
And finally, I can't let you go without asking about the work done by photographer Lou Bope, who was featured in the film, the still photographer mm-hmm. who captured those amazing images.
Lou, I knew because I lived in his basement for a while. That's how we met. And it seems almost serendipitous now because he was the perfect person for this project. He treated the rooms with such respect. It was almost the rooms were like a church for him. In the film, you see him taking off his shoes. Nobody else did, but he felt he had to take off his shoes before he entered that space. Refused to touch anything in the room. Just, you know, looked around, looked closely, looked under the beds, looked under the desks, looked in the trash cans for anything that could show America who this child is and was. And thank goodness for him, because without those amazing images, there would be no documentary.
According to the K-12 school shooting database, school shooting incidents in the U.S. have spiked in recent years, including mass shooting cases that we've covered on this show, like the Oxford High School shooting, the Appalachian High School shooting, and the Robb Elementary School shooting in Uvalde, Texas. So far this year, the database shows that nearly 40 school shootings have been reported, and a recent peak of 352 in a single year was reported back in 2023. Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to WWJ News Radio in Detroit, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, the Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, and KCBS Radio in the Bay Area. You can stream these stations on the Odyssey app, and you can find their podcast feeds on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get these true crime updates by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Dana Carvey.
I'm David Spade.
Fly on the Wall's back for another season now on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
So many incredible guests will be joining us.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Too good to be true.